This is Monocle on Design. I'm Josh Fennett. On today's show...
I never met a designer who didn't get up in the morning saying, I'm going to do something today to make the world a better place. Designers are so positive, and designers can make the world a better place.
We meet the storied designer John Sorrell to talk creative education and his role in London's forthcoming Design Week and Biennale. Plus...
When you ask me, what is a closed world? It's an environment that operates in a cycle where output can become input. Your body is a system that generates output and takes input. And so if you had to eat what you excrete, that would be a closed world.
We talk to an author about closed architecture and meet the Irish interior whiz behind a seemly new Dublin stopover. All that coming up right here on Monocle on Design with me, Josh Fennett. Do stay tuned. Now, debates about urbanism and design have long focused on opening up spaces to the public, but today we're turning our attention to so-called closed architecture. From space capsules to submarines and self-contained housing estates, shopping centres or office buildings, these are pieces of design that are intended to contain the people who use them. Architect, engineer and scholar Lydia Calapoliti takes a closer look at the architecture of closed worlds in her new book of the same name, published by Lars Müller.
The architecture of closed worlds, or what is the power of shit? The second part, which is the more contentious part of the title, is a metaphor. And it is a metaphor about a logic of recirculating resources on a planetary scale and how that idea has been used in architectural design, environmental design, and the design of spaces throughout the 20th century. And this logic was resurged, basically, when we faced the whole Earth in the late 1960s. And you could see the Earth as a finite space, and the idea that all leftover materials from one cycle of production could be reused in another cycle of production. So in many ways, that metaphor is both technical, because shit is a material that can be used for producing methane or gas and generate power, but at the same time, it refers to a kind of logic of converting materials that are the output of one cycle of production into useful materials. So when you ask me, what is a closed world, or what does that mean? It's very simple. It's an environment that operates in a cycle where all output can become input, or most of output can become input. Your body is a system that generates output and takes input. And so if you had to eat what you excrete, that would be a closed world. Now, of course, this can't happen 100%, and neither can it happen in an environment. But a kind of very evident example is the space program. So in order to move human life into outer space, in the 50s, when they started working on this problem on life support systems, they realized that they have to use the outputs of human life of the body to generate input for a sustainable space, because they couldn't carry all the water, they couldn't carry all the resources and launch a rocket at the same time. And that created a logic of recirculation, and space became the vessel or the medium that would adjust itself to make that recirculation happen. So that is a closed world, but it can be a lot of different things. It's not just a spaceship. It can be a diving, breathing apparatus. It can be a kind of toilet that doesn't take water and creates compost for something else. This logic has been applied to so many different systems, and that kind of recirculation logic that I'm referring to has been applied from, let's say, very technical systems like submarines, diving units, space capsules, to the earliest ecological houses in the 60s and 70s that used the same kind of logic of recirculation of resources. and more recently into really large destinations for, in quotes, ecological tourism like the Eden Project and Masdar City, or what architects and designers sometimes reference as net zero environments. So in the book, I reference the closed world as the architecture of disappearance. This doesn't mean that there is no aestheticization or no design of anything. It means that the idea of design is transferred to the engineering of systems rather than a kind of formal proposition with disciplinary rules on how to draw a kind of certain environment or building. There are 37 living prototypes in the book. All of them have been built. They're all experiments, and they're all lived in by either humans or other organisms. These are three that stand out.
It is called Biosphere 2, a totally self-contained environment complete with rainforest, desert, marsh, and marine habitats. And this is its first wall, now being lifted into place at the Sunspace Ranch near Oracle.
The mission of Biosphere 2 is to very simply make a difference.
This is an exploration, and we are moving into new territory. And such kinds of exploration are always controversial. But we know what we're doing, and we have a team of scientists from all over the world who are participating in our research. They think we know what we're doing, and so we're confident.
This is the most famous living prototype out of the book, and it also is the most controversial one. There have been several books, critiques about this experiment. It was one of the first giant human experiments, an Earth colony replicating, let's say, a colony in Mars that was inhabited as an experiment for 2 years by the first crew. It opened and was sealed with a crew of people in 1991.
Right. Let's do the math. Our service mission here was supposed to last 31 souls. For redundancy, they sent 68 souls worth of food. That's for six people. So for just me, that's going to last 300 souls, which I figure I can stretch to 400 if I ration. So I got to figure out a way to grow 3 years worth of food here on a planet where nothing grows. Luckily, I'm a botanist.
The inhabitants, called biospherians, couldn't import anything, so the facility was entirely sealed. It had five different climates. It had an ocean inside. It had animals. No air was coming in from the outside. And the biospherians were tasked to produce their own food and live in that facility for an extended period of time.
40 rats are taking a trip to space, but without leaving the lab. Scientists are testing them as if they were astronauts. It's all part of an experiment to create a self-sufficient ecosystem inside a spaceship, so it doesn't need to return to Earth to replenish supplies. 300 scientists, coordinated by the European Space Agency, are participating in this project, which was presented in Barcelona today.
MELISSA is an abbreviation for Microecological Life Support System. It is a kind of multifaceted experiment by the European Space Agency. It's still going on. It's an ongoing project from 1995 to today, and it is estimated that it will run for another maybe 30 to 60 to 80 years. They don't know. And what they're trying to do is to replicate a cubic feet of a lake in several machines and really be extremely precise about how to sustain an ecosystem with entirely artificial means. It was astonishing to visit that facility and that research experiment and see how much it would weigh to create 1 cubic feet of lake artificially. It was tons of steel and machinery. Ecological House. This was an experiment by an architect that belonged to an anarchist group. His name was Graham Kane, and the group was Street Farmers. Sometimes the Ecological House was referred to as the Street Farmhouse. And it was built in the 1970s as a living experiment. He lived there along with his family. And the interesting thing about this house, I mean, there's a lot of interesting aspects, but one of them is that it was a precarious construction. It was a very low tech. and it supported a political ideology by its makers. It wasn't just a technical experiment to use his shit to feed the garden and grow bananas, which was the case, but it was also a kind of statement, a political statement to not use the resources of the state, to be disconnected and grow your own food, generate your own power. And it was part of a larger movement of emancipation from the grid of supplies at that time.
It was good to be back in the wilderness again, where everything seems at peace. I was alone, just me and the animals. It was a great feeling, free once more to plan and do as I pleased.
A thousand thanks to Monocle's Ed Stocker, speaking there to architect, engineer and scholar Lydia Calapoliti. The Architecture of Closed Worlds is out next month and published by Lars Müller. Next up, we're privileged to speak to a doyen of the design industry in the form of Sir John Sorrell. Sorrell set up his first design firm in the mid-1960s and has ceaselessly campaigned for better design education and upping the clout of the creative industries. He's also the president of London Design Biennale from the 4th to the 23rd of September at Somerset House and the chairman of the London Design Festival, which runs for a week from September 15th. I sat down with John to ask about the importance of such forums and why to host them here in London.
These events are really important to London because not only do they add to what is already a very, very wonderful cultural city, they also are very helpful to the economy because they attract people who spend money in all kinds of places, and that's good for London. But of course, the real thing that, you know, that I'm excited about is how they affect and help the London cultural scene. It's such a great city for anybody who wants to do all kinds of different things, but we bring an extraordinary design period to the city every September with the festival and every 2 years now with the Biennale. And if you're interested in design, you've got to be here because it is design at the cutting edge. It's about new design. And most important of all, it's an enormous conversation by people or with people from all over the world who are crazy about design and they want to share the way they feel with everyone else.
And the ripples of the conversations that are started at these events can often be seen rearing their heads later. If there's a conversation about sustainability, someone may reference something that a way that a country tackled that issue. But I'm keen to know, in a design calendar that feels fuller and fuller every year, how do you keep the offering sharp and how do you make sure that London's Design Festival or the Biennale are really at the cutting edge of what people are talking about and really relevant?
Well, take the festival first. This is the 16th edition of the London Design Festival. We launched the first one in 2003, and since then, at least 130 cities have produced their own version. They're very often called Design Weeks, but they're essentially the same idea, which I think is great. When people started doing very similar things to us a long time ago, I was a bit annoyed, but now I think it's great because it shows how important design is to the world. Every city in the world now knows how important design is to their economics and to, if you like, their social good. So if you're doing an event like this, as we are, you've got to get in front of everybody else. You've got to do things that are new, that are exciting, that are inspiring, and which people are seeing for the first time. And I think more and more, with people's attention being caught by every single aspect of technology that you can imagine, it's tough to keep in front of the game, but that's what we try and do. So we're interested in new things, we're interested in new ideas particularly, we're interested in new people, and I think that has kept every year the festival very, very fresh. The Biennale, of course, which happens every 2 years, is different because it's one single event with 40 countries, cities and territories from all over the world, plus some special projects, where what everyone's doing is responding to a theme every 2 years. This year it's emotional states, which has really proved to be very popular and very exciting. So in itself, that is absolutely new. No one's seen it before because no one's seen an exhibition responding to that theme before. And I think people will be surprised, perhaps shocked a bit. I think some of the exhibits in Somerset House during the Biennale will make people smile. but it will certainly be at the cutting edge.
The theme is emotional states, and sitting across from you, I can't imagine you being anything other than patient and genial, but I imagine it is not limited as a theme to getting people to talk about purely comfortable suggestions. What was the idea with throwing down this gauntlet, and can you give us a little bit of an insight into the emotional state of the participants this year?
Well, how long have we got? The idea is Chris Turner's, who is our curator. He curated the 2016 Biennale with a wonderful theme, Utopia, because it was the 500th anniversary of Thomas More's book. This time, what Chris is proposing is I think, a very topical subject. The world seems to be more emotional now than it perhaps ever has been. And so, of course, there's the double play on the words. What most people are responding with are really very genuine feelings about what's going on in the world from their point of view and from a design point of view. Sometimes really very challenging, sometimes at the other end of the spectrum with a sense of fun. And so it is basically every emotion you can imagine. Joy, happiness, sadness, fear, disgust, and so on. What a wonderful theme for a Biennale, for any exhibition, actually. I don't think it's ever been done before.
Design can often be seen in terms of rationality, of paring something down to do a very simple job and to do it as efficiently as possible. So I love the idea of emotional states as connecting somehow to our humanity. How important is it to get designers talking about these things? These are usually the reserve of policy wonks and governments, you know, talking about social equality. How important is it for designers to be part of that debate as well?
I think they talk more about these things than politicians and policymakers do. I've never met a designer who didn't get up in the morning saying, I'm going to do something today to make the world a better place. Designers are so positive, and designers can make the world a better place. So in my entire career, I've met and worked with so many people, from designers of every single discipline, who want to make things better. And so all these big issues, like sustainability, which is a big, big subject these days, but so are things like climate change, so are things like shortage of water in parts of the world, so are things like migration. Designers are all over these subjects. They talk about them all the time. And I think the honest truth is that they're the ones who are going to come up with the answers. I don't think the politicians will come up with the answers. And so my message really to all politicians always is, do talk to designers, listen to them. They may well have some brilliant ideas which will really make things better.
I completely agree. And I'm going to ask you a question that I find a little bit dispiriting myself, as all conversations seem inexorably to roll heavily towards the subject of Brexit. But I think it's not something that's been talked about with regards to the creative industries. We're seeing architecture studios particularly that have very long lead times, facing a lot of uncertainty about whether they'll be entitled to build in Europe, the way in which competitions will work in future. I know that you have strong opinions on this and whether Brexit and how Brexit will affect the creative industries. We're lacking a long-term plan. Is that the only problem with Brexit and the UK, that people are unable to plan for the future when we withdraw in March?
Well, two or three things. First of all, I founded the Creative Industries Federation, and when they did a survey of their members to ask which way they voted, 96% said they voted Remain. So on the whole, it would seem pretty clear that creative industries like the situation as it is. And that is because I believe that we have the most international creative community in the world here in the UK. And some of those people are fundamentally important to some of the different parts of the creative sector, especially the people from Europe. So obviously people are worried about how they're going to populate their businesses, not just architects. Animation, for example, special effects, 40% of all the special effects people in the business in this country are from Europe. So obviously there's a lot of worry and concern. I don't know what's going to emerge from it any more than anyone else does. What I would say on the positive side is that I've been around in this game for such a long time. I've seen so many different things going on. I've been through periods of austerity a long time before the recent ones. I've seen terrible recessions. And you know what? We have the most extraordinary resilience in this country and the ability to bounce back from difficulty. And I believe that creative people, and especially designers, are the best in the world at bouncing back from adversity. So sometimes adversity breeds the most extraordinary creativity. And I'm hoping that whatever happens, and I've got no idea what will happen, whatever happens, we will fight as hard as we can do to make sure that our creative sector is the best in the world, which it is now. We just want it to continue that way.
Many thanks to the esteemed Sir John Sorrell there. He's president of the London Design Biennale, on from the 4th to the 23rd of September, lest you forget. And in his spare time, he's also the chairman of the London Design Festival, which runs for a week from September the 15th. Do go along. Now, Dublin's a pricey place, but while its restaurant scene has roused nicely, the stock of decent design-minded hotels hasn't stirred much. Until now, perhaps. The former industrial area, a few steps from Merrion Square, has been revived with a 105-key affair overseen by interior architect John Henry Boyle of Dublin-based practice 21 Spaces. The open lobby of the Alex Hotel leads to a fetching dining area dotted with low banquettes, a peachy colour scheme and 50s-style furniture, much of it made for purpose by Irish craftsmen. To discuss Boyle's burgeoning interior design practice at 21 Spaces and the changing state of Irish design, I caught up with John Henry recently.
It was like someone turned a tap off in 2008, to be quite honest with you, in Ireland. Not dissimilar, I guess, to most parts of the world, but in particular Ireland. It was like a tsunami came through, closed down a lot of businesses we had worked with previously, a lot of really good tradespeople and all that sort of thing. But we were fortunate. We were kind of mobile. We were young. We were creative. We had a very strong client base that was mixed bag between retail and hospitality. And I guess that, in a funny sense of the word, in that shaking of the tree back then had allowed us really to cast off the developers' concept of ostentatiousness and everything and get back to basics, which is creativity, really create a model of a language for the studio. And I think that's also happened across Ireland. I think it's happened across Britain. It happens across pretty much the Western world, particularly in the US as well. And I think there's good quality craft, honest work being done now. And if there is a silver lining to that cloud, it's definitely that. Yeah.
Well, it's interesting. Good always to glean positive lessons from tough times. The next thing I'd like to ask you about is another change which happened at that point. I suppose the internet, the prevalence of the internet that you mentioned, has also reshaped many of our experiences of retail and of hospitality. If we want a lodging in a city, we can borrow someone else's living room, it seems, through Airbnb. If we want to purchase a book, forget the secondhand bookshop, we can go to Amazon and get it. How important or how much responsibility does that place on you, a person that makes physical retail spaces and designs hospitality environments, to kind of shake people by the shoulders and say, look, you're here now?
Yes, I think that's probably a defining moment of our generation, to be honest with you. I think it's almost like that whole disruptive nature of the internet, whether it be Airbnb, whether it be Amazon, whether it be Apple, whether it be Ryanair. It's that whole model of doing business has completely changed. And it's allowed us really, to be honest with you, as lateral thinkers, to go out there and not only design physical spaces, but actually help engage brands to understand what they're about. And that manifests itself not only in the physical sort of well-being or retail aspect of a structure, architectural aspect of a store, but it also allows a client to, I guess, really retrace what they're about, you know, and where they want to go. And I guess it's all about emotional intelligence in terms of, like, how do you want to capture that audience? How do you want to keep that audience? Where do you want to take that audience? And as creative thinkers, I think it's an onus upon us really to help steer that journey for a client.
So it's interesting. So you think clients maybe have become a little bit more reflexive. They acknowledge why they're trying to get people and how they want those people to feel in the environment. I think if we were talking wooden tables and brass tacks, you know, how can you give us an example of a project that you've done, how you've enlivened a retail space for a brand, or, you know, brought to them an idea about how they can engage their customers, maybe a little bit differently?
Yeah, well, we did one of Ireland's largest sports retailers, Lifestyle Sports. So recently we were engaged to create a project for them in a vast space of 30,000 square foot in Cork City, which is the second biggest city in Ireland. And it was really interesting project because it wasn't dictated by brands in terms of course the brands had to live within our format, but we were challenged with how do we fill this vast space. So our model and our methodology in terms of what we employed was to encourage, I guess, the retailer to look at the customer. How do you keep customer? How do you increase dwell time? You know, how do you engage with them even if they don't purchase within their retail experience, you know, make them come back, make them buy online. So what we did there was we created football cages, we created synthetic running tracks around the place, even down to something as low-tech as board games and community boards, you know, really simple things, stuff that would engage with the demographic that obviously the sports retailer had crammed into 2,000 square feet previously, but up to 30,000 square feet, they had to fill it with some void, you know. So it's that whole theatrics, that whole interaction of customer, etc. And then there's another example, I suppose, in, which is almost similar, but in a different sphere altogether, which is the Alex Hotel, which is recently completed in Dublin, which is a 1990s building reimagined. It's over five stories. So what we tried to encourage the client to do there was to create a co-working area within the whole of the ground floor area of the reception, so that it, they knew they weren't very strong on the food and beverage side of it. What we encouraged them to do was bring a third-party coffee operator in, and we hived off one of the main entrances. And within that there, then, there was like a very small craft coffee offering within the unit.
And I had the good fortune to visit the Alex Hotel not too long ago and see the space for myself. It is a rather beautiful building and a rather remarkable turnaround for a hotel that certainly didn't look like that before. Yeah. One thing that really struck me was the use of different textures and different materials. Mm. Is that one of the ways that you can kind of arrest people, that you can give them a haptic experience, that you can show them that they're not just passing through, that, you know, gets people to linger, touch, smell, hear those materials? And how did you go about picking that palette?
Going about picking it, I suppose I'd have to trace back to my roots, which is back, dare I say it, 40 years ago, back in the west of Donegal, which is in the northwest of Ireland. It's a change in environment, you know, and that sort of explosion of texture, colour, smoothness, roughness from the ocean, how it batters off the environment. That was very much a driving influence on my youth, and also, I guess, the Scandinavian architecture then, which I would have studied then through my career, was also a very large influence. And then when employing that then to its pinnacle then in the Alex Hotel was a joy to behold, really, to be honest with you, because I've always tried to inspire within the studio, really, to look at our materials, to work with our materials. Are very precious, you know. I don't take them too lightly, you know. Timber is a very scarce commodity, as is ceramics or marbles or anything such as, you know. So it's very important to treat them thus, you know. What I like to get out of a space after we sit back and critique it is the fact that I really want somebody to engage with the space, but I want them to engage with the space, not first off. I'd like them to work with the space, the customer to work with the space, to sit down and then be pleasantly surprised and then subliminally touched by something that might they may not have imagined that they were going to see.
John Henry Boyle there, what a man. He's the founder of Dublin-based interior architecture practice and the firm behind the newly revamped Alex Hotel there, speaking to me a little earlier. And it's with regret that that's all we have time for on this week's show. If you're short on a little design-minded inspiration, then do delve into our fashion-forward final issue of the Summer Weekly series, which is out from this Thursday, or, failing that, the September issue of the magazine. Both are available at all self-respecting newsstands, or, failing that, at monocle.com. Monocle on Design was produced by Daphne Karnesis and edited by the ever-patient Christy Evans. I'm Josh Fennett. Thank you very much for listening. Ta-ta.